Hi everyone, it's Eli. You know how sometimes you stumble upon something truly game-changing in healthcare? Well, I found it. Kinetisense. This cutting-edge motion capture technology is transforming movement, assessment, and recovery. Imagine getting instant AI-driven insights without any wearables on your patient. That's right, no ping pong balls needed. Just pure, accurate data. Perfect for boosting athletic performance, pinpointing imbalances, and refining rehab. Top professionals worldwide trust Kinetisense to maximize productivity and results. Check out our partner page to learn more. Experience the revolution in movement. Welcome to Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More, the podcast that gives you a viewpoint in sports medicine that can't be found anywhere else. I'm your host, Eli Halleck, and we have a fantastic show ahead of us today. So let's get started. Today, this is going to be something completely new to me. You hear, again, a little bit of excitement in my voice. I have Victoria Chavez here with me helping to interview our guest. Hey, Victoria, how you doing?
Hey, Eli, I'm doing great. How are you?
I am just peachy. I'm kind of excited about this guest because, well, let's face it, I use clips from this industry all the time when I'm teaching my class. I love this. It's so fun to watch. I know probably every athletic trainer has sat there and gone, ooh, wouldn't that be fun to work? And now we get to find out about UFC. Yes, that's right, UFC. Today, our guest is the director, clinical manager of UFC Institute, Robert Bobby Gaisford. Hey, Bobby, how you doing today?
Good. How are you guys?
We're great.
Just want to start with thanks for having me on, for sure.
Excited. I'm excited you're here. I know a lot of us have always wondered, how the heck does this go on? What do you do back there? So this is really cool that you agreed to be here, especially taking time out of your day, because I'm sure as an athletic trainer at UFC, you're just a tad bit busy.
Yeah, job security is a real buzzword around here.
I don't doubt that one bit. Kind of like us working at all boys high school. You never know what dumb thing's going to happen, right?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Well, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started and how you got to the UFC, that would be fantastic.
My background's obviously strictly athletic training. We've got a couple on staff that are, you know, dual credentialed, but mine's strictly athletic training. So I did my undergrad in a bachelor's of athletic training at Colorado State University of Pueblo. So a little Division II school down in Pueblo, Colorado. Originally from Colorado Springs, so that wasn't too far from home, about a 40-minute drive or so. So graduated there 2011, forever ago, and then went on and got my master's in athletic training at the University of South Florida. Kind of spell that out. That degree was a master's of medical sciences with an emphasis in athletic training and a specialization in youth sport epidemiology. So big,
that's
long
a mouthful.
Yeah, big, long mouthful. Really was afraid that it was going to pigeonhole me into working, you know, at the high school level or even, you know, younger athlete, which wasn't something that I was opposed to doing. I just knew that I kind of, you know, would have liked to have gotten to the professional level, but kind of all avenues when I applied to grad school kind of funneled down into this program. So I was there for 2 years and then moved back to Colorado Springs and ended up getting a job at the Olympic Training Center.
Of course, over there, that's the big thing.
Yeah, so which is really funny because when I started my path in athletic training, I literally was born in the hospital right next to the Olympic Training Center and never thought about the Olympic sports as a pathway. I don't know.
You're kidding me. How do you not think about that?
No, I was like, it doesn't even make sense. And then, yeah, when it came, I had a former undergrad teacher, I think, that sent me the job application. And so I applied for it and thought it was the worst interview I'd ever done in my life and got the position. So I was there for...
I think we both know that feeling, don't we?
Yeah. I was there at the Olympic Training Center for 3.5 years. A primary responsibility there was covering men's gymnastics practice and then kind of, you know, backfilling where needed with wrestling and boxing. were like the only three sports on campus that they actually provided like active, I guess, like medical coverage at practices. Everything else, we were kind of on campus while they were going on. Went to the Pan American Games in Toronto in 2015, and then went down to Rio for the Olympic Games in 2016. So those were both pretty cool experiences. And then one of the PTs at the Olympic Training Center was recruited for the director position here, Heather Linden. So Heather and I worked at the Olympic Training Center together for 3.5 years. And when she got recruited, you know, I was just kind of, you know, ready for something different. So I told her when she left, I was ready and willing to, you know, go on to anything when she needed a second person at the PI.
Go on to something different. I think you found that, didn't you?
Yeah. This population is quite a bit different. So yeah, while, you know, obviously I had the experience covering boxing and wrestling at the Olympic Training Center, and then even a little bit of judo at the Olympics, the MMA athlete is completely different. Obviously, it's not just one discipline, you know, it's not just basketball practice. It's not just wrestling practice. It's, you know, it's wrestling, it's striking, it's jujitsu, it's strength and conditioning on top of that. So yeah, very, very interesting when it comes down to scheduling these athletes, whether it's for treatment or rehabs, their schedules, you know, kind of all over the place. So getting them in one place for, you know, any period of time is difficult.
Kind of interesting how you went through the Olympics. Born next door, didn't even think about it. How many of us never think about working for where we're living, which is kind of odd, kind of fun. And then when it happens, it's kind of like, wow, I'm working at the Olympic arena. I mean, how cool was that?
Yeah,
and then going down to Rio.
Yeah. There was definitely one of those wow moments covering particularly the gold medal match, because one of the Americans, Kayla Harrison, actually won gold that year. That was her second back-to-back gold, I believe. She, you know, sitting there, I wasn't mat side because they, like, the way the tournament was set up was they had, I guess, basically Olympic Games volunteers that actually did anything mat side. So if anything happened on the mat, they would have been the ones responding. But I was basically right there, kind of behind second row, so to speak. Yeah, just sitting there watching it and be like, wow, like, okay, I guess I've kind of maybe accomplished something in my career to this point. So that was definitely an awesome experience.
So when all our parents looked at us and said, what do you mean athletic training? You're going to be a strength conditioning coach?
Yeah.
You kind of got to say, hey, mom, dad, look at me. Yeah. I'm at the Olympics.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, I still not entirely sure my parents understand exactly everything that, you know, an athletic trainer does. But, you know, it's a slow education.
Would you agree with that, Victoria?
Oh, 100%. I give them effort for trying, though.
I mean, it's crazy even when you get people within the medical profession that still look, oh, you're an athletic trainer, so you train athletes? Like, no.
Constantly educating, right? Doesn't matter who it is.
Yeah. Though sometimes I give up and be like, yep, that's exactly what I am.
Sure, whatever.
Whatever helps you.
Right.
I hear you there. So UFC, Ultimate Fighting. Oh my God. I'm a big trauma guy. That's why, even though I've been at the high school level for 27 years, I love football because you never know what's going to happen. But then you are there.
Yep.
And what is a day like? Can you walk me through what it's like being an athletic trainer in the day of either practice and then or an event?
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, here at the Performance Institute, we really kind of strive to be in professional sports and still kind of work that, you know, work-life balance, so to speak. So I'm still pretty close to a 40-hour work week, probably about, you know, 90% of the time when we travel. Yeah, can't beat it.
That's awesome. That's so awesome.
You know, it's pretty unheard of. You know, I had yesterday off for Memorial Day. We try and take care of ourselves outside. We work, you know, it's a fast paced environment for sure. And there's no off season for us. So we kind of take it, fit it in where we can get it in type of thing. Yeah. We see patients kind of on an hour basis, 8 to 5, we get them for an hour. We can get them for 30 minutes if we only need it. But I would say a large portion of my day is just kind of patient care. And we see anything from rehabs, post-op, prehabs, preventative, like you name it, we see everything. I would say the thing I do the least is actual like practice coverage. if you've ever watched any of the videos on YouTube of, you know, just a general tour of the PI, we've got it downstairs, which is kind of all our technical space where you've got nutrition, strength conditioning, sports science, sports medicine. And then upstairs is kind of the whole like sports specific floor. So you've got the two octagons, you've got mat space, you got back space. So people are constantly training in the PI throughout the day. We don't necessarily have somebody specifically sitting, you know, cage side, mat side, whatever, covering any sort of practices, at least here at the PI in Vegas. Our two other sites, Mexico City and Shanghai, operate a little bit differently because they have an academy component to it. So there actually is a team aspect to some degree in those locations, and they will they'll actually cover practice because everybody's kind of practicing at one time. It's a 2-hour block in the morning, 2-hour block in the evening type of thing. And they're actually sitting mat side covering all that stuff. In addition to that, we, like I said, we travel to all, we generally have like 42 to 44 events a year. So we're a staff of 4, about to be 5 in Las Vegas, 2 in Shanghai, or sorry, 3 in Shanghai, 2 in Mexico. And we kind of all rotate between the fights each week. You know, there's a large amount of them still in Vegas, but we'll send 1 or 2 staff members to each fight week outside of Vegas and just kind of rotate through that. So that week, we're basically seeing them 10 to 10 sort of scheduled, you know, and they schedule, you know, basically recovery type sessions, mostly at that point, right? There's no real sense of any sort of rehab unless there's a specific injury the week of their fight. We'll treat them throughout the week. And then Saturday, we now work at the events, which is kind of new within the last like 6 to 8 months of our role, being at the events, kind of passing out durable medical equipment after the fight, kind of depending on, they go through an evaluation from the commission doc. And then we kind of, you know, either crutches, braces, boots, slings, you name it.
Now, is that across the board immediately after the bout, everybody goes through an evaluation from the doc?
Yep. So across the board, both come back in, each has kind of a room in the arena somewhere, get a quick, I mean, it's very brief. And then, you know, suspensions and kind of follow-ups are given from there. You know, you need 90-day suspension for fight, 45-day suspension for contact, depending on the bout, depending how it ended type of thing. And then like, or they need, you know, full clearance from a neurologist. They need a full clearance with a negative MRI, X-ray, what have you. Anything kind of concussion related or anything they're kind of really unsure about, they'll put them in a 30-minute hold. And they just kind of hang out with us 30 minutes, kind of do a brief concussion screen with them in that room. And then as long as their symptoms are improving, they'll kind of go on about their way. They'll go back to the hotel. They also, you know, sometimes are transported directly to the hospital, sometimes straight from those evals right after the bout.
So you mentioned neurologists, sorry. Do you guys contact them based on the fight or do they specifically work for UFC?
The commission docs?
Yeah, the commission docs and, you know, nutrition and stuff like that, like team-wise.
Yeah, so our team here in Vegas, or well, at any of the PIs. So, right, we're a very interdisciplinary model, and that's kind of the, you know, the goal for all of this is we've all come from places that may claim to be interdisciplinary and really kind of fail to meet that. And that is, you know, kind of our, you know, gold standard. If we're not doing it at the end of the day, then we're failing, you know, ourselves first and foremost, and then
and also, your patients, your athletes. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So, on staff here, we have sports scientists, strength conditioning coaches, sports medicine, dietitians, and then we also contract out sports psych. So we have that component as well. And I think I hit every department. We also obviously don't operate without our operations team, but
yeah, you better throw them out there. You need them, right?
Yeah, because that takes a huge headache off of our end. So we've got all of that in-house. And then separate from all that, each state has an athletic commission. So it's the California State Athletic Commission, which sanctions the fight, essentially. So
now, is that the same institute that would do boxing in California? Or
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
And then they have a pool of physicians. They're usually, you know, physicians all across the board from sports medicine, orthopedics to ER docs to we always usually have somebody in the arena that can suture. And so that's kind of all across the board on who they bring in for that.
Actually, one of the doctors my wife works a lot with, Dr. I forget his first name, Dr. Fox, is out here in LA and has done a lot with UFC and MMA over the years.
Yeah. We a lot of times, you know, when we're in certain areas, it's usually always the same doc. So you kind of, you know, get a feel, even though it's a separate entity. And we the UFC, I don't know exactly the pathway with all that stuff, but we basically can't tell them what to do, type of thing, right? That's separate, kind of involves, you know, just having too much hands in the process. But it's nice having the same docs kind of going back to some of these places routinely to, you know, get that standard of care for sure.
Build that rapport and you know you can trust them.
Yeah, exactly. Because when we go to international fights, it's kind of, you know, it's all over the place. And it seems like it was either, you know, the staff was really good or
not so much.
Yeah, exactly.
So. What kind of, well, let's ask the question that all my students are going to look at me and ask every day. And I know my student over here would ask me, Mr. Howard, you got to ask him, what's the worst injury he's ever dealt with? So I'm just going to ask that because I know my students are going to want to know, what have you seen?
So yeah, that's an interesting one. Obviously, everywhere you go, everybody always asks you that question. Like, what's the craziest injury you've seen?
Doesn't matter.
Tell us.
Doesn't matter what profession, what level in the profession. It never fails.
Yeah. I can, and honestly, like, knock on wood, I can't say that we've seen too many crazy things
knocking on wood right now. There we go.
Yeah. Or it just means that we've been doing it too long and the crazy is normal to us now.
There you go. Yeah, totally.
I would say that the biggest thing that both Heather and I noticed right away is that, you know, somebody would come in after a fight, their leg would literally be 2 to 3 times the size, their foot would be 2 to 3 times the size, and you're like, oh, that's for sure broken. You need to go get an x-ray. And they would always come back negative. And it's just like, so it was like, it's gotten to a point where it's like, man, I don't even think I'm going to x-ray that now. Like,
just from all the trauma, they're getting tons of swelling,
I guess that's the craziest part, is just the, like, you think there's a bunch of trauma there and it just kind of proves how resilient the body actually is.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. That's. I mean, I haven't been involved with any of them, but we've had, like, you know, watching the fights from home, you've had people dislocate their elbows. You've had a full, like, tib fib fracture off of first kick of the fight.
I've got a couple of those videos. I use them every year in class and watch a couple of kids turn green. So yeah, no, great stuff.
Yeah, exactly. They go step back on a leg that's not even there anymore. So.
Oh yeah. And down goes Frazier.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct me if I'm wrong, athletic trainers typically aren't going to be the first ones responding. That you guys are more post-game, in-house type of work.
Yeah, for sure. A lot more, you know, post-fight. So, and we're not even, once they get to that, like, medical evaluation after the fight, you know, we're doing a little bit of evaluation if there's kind of time for it, but mostly that's the commission doc. And that's hey, do you need a brace or get this man like a left thumb splint or a walking boot or crutches? And then once they kind of come back into the doors, the PI doors on Monday, that's kind of when we kind of step in. There's not really too much that happens inside of the fight in general. You'll have the cut men kind of come in as part of the fighter's corner, and they're managing the lacerations or any bleeding, whether it's nose laceration or ear, head, whatever, you name it. They're managing that. And then that's really kind of, other than, you know, the referee will occasionally call a doctor in between rounds. So kind of, you know, can they still see out of this eye that's basically swollen shut, a low blow type of thing. But yeah, there's not really much that goes on in between or in the fight in general. And even talked about, you know, because we've seen some of these instances where they've, you know, dislocated their elbow and they're sitting there waiting to get their opponent's hand raised, you know, holding their elbow in place. And it's like, well, can we help that process? Can we get them a sling at least while they're, and it, we just basically, like, it's something to do with the athletic commission, something to do with the optics of the sport itself. You know, obviously MMA is still pretty young in its infancy. We just celebrated our 30-year anniversary last year with the UFC.
Right. Founded in 1993, November 12th. Look that up.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, you still got places where it's technically illegal. Like France just legalized MMA.
Really?
2 years ago.
Really?
Or something like that.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So we've only had two. We've had two fights in Paris now in the last 2 years. But yeah, they just legalized it. So it's still a very barbaric sport. I guess they
can't argue that. I mean, you can use your elbow, you can use your knee, you can use anything.
Anything, basically. Yeah.
It's a free for all, which is absolutely amazing when you see some of the trauma, like you said, that people are going through and they get back up and get going. It blows my mind when I'm watching some of those bouts.
Yeah. Yeah. You think somebody's absolutely finished and they come back and end up winning the fight. But yeah, it's funny sitting there watching the fights because you're like, oh, yep, I'm going to have to deal with that on Monday, and I'm going to have to deal with that on Monday, and I'm going to have to deal with that on Monday. Like,
checklist.
Yeah. So, like I said at the beginning, job security will always exist in this profession. There's no amount of preventative care we could provide.
And I feel like a baby. I stub my toe and I'm out for like 10 minutes. I'm like, okay, guys.
Yeah.
Well, next person.
At that point, these guys and girls are really tough, but then when we get them on the treatment table, they're generally pretty soft. I'm like, you get punched in the face. Yeah, but honestly, it doesn't hurt that bad. I'm like, I call it.
And so my elbow helping your paraspinals on a massage is killing you.
Yeah.
But that elbow to the face did nothing.
Did nothing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Subscap release, pec release.
Driving
the traps, like all that. They're like, no.
Oh,
or it's the guys that are covered in head to toe from tattoos that don't want you to needle them.
Okay, that's funny.
It makes total sense, right? Like, I've had guys that like literally are, you know, heads covered, tattoos literally right next to their eyes, and they're like, no, I'm afraid of needles. Oh,
what? Now, you got those tats, right? Real quick.
But it's different.
Could you explain? We've got just a handful of listeners. And one of them is my sister. She's an English major. She's a teacher at high school and doesn't know when we say needling, what we're talking about. Could you explain that? Because I know you guys are trained and you do needling in your clinic.
Yeah. So we do a ton of dry needling in the clinic. In Nevada, athletic trainers are allowed to do it. I know that's different from you guys in California.
Very jealous. Very jealous.
Yeah. Well, short story about that. The Nevada tried to, you know, block it all from everybody except for acupuncture, similar to California, literally like 2 weeks after I had gotten certified. And the UFC actually was part of the group that stepped in and kind of kiboshed that. And
nice.
So that was, they were like, how much is this going to affect you guys? And we're like, pretty significantly if we can't do it. So they helped stepped in and helped take care of that. Very similar to acupuncture. Same needles. That's kind of why the acupuncturists obviously come after us, but with a different intent, right? Like with acupuncture, I always tell athletes that with acupuncture, I'm going to stick it in your calf to help treat something in your shoulder or something going on internally. Whereas if I'm dry needling, I'm going specifically after that body part, right? If I'm going to dry needle your traps, I'm sticking it directly in the traps. So that's kind of how I describe it to people.
So Angela, if you're out there, it's a needle. And it's going in, and you wouldn't like it. Love you, kid, but I know. And also, my daughter, if she happens to listen to this episode, I think she's listened to one. Dry needling, you'll never do it. She wants to go into physician assistant school, and she's deathly afraid of needles. And she, too, has a few tats, so I think it's hilarious.
Yeah, it's a weird concept, right?
Totally. Thanks for explaining that.
Yeah.
So, looking at the system as a whole, would you consider that there are any areas that need improvement, or as of right now, it's already in good standing?
So like system as in like what we have here at the Performance Institute, or just kind of like, I guess, medical care
as a whole for UFC, like game day.
Maybe break it into both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If okay, one area is weaker than the other.
I would say here at the PI, like, we go through our, you know, our ups and downs, but at the end of the day, we're still at such a high level that the athlete doesn't even notice, right? So, you know, if there is a communication breakdown with our S&C team or our nutrition team or whatever department it may be, to us internally, oh, it looks like we failed the system, but the athlete still is like, oh my God, this is still you know, the highest level of care I've ever received. So to that point, I'd say like communication's always at the forefront of making sure that interdisciplinary approach works. So that's probably the biggest struggle, especially the fast pace that we operate at, is making sure that that happens.
And I'm sure part of it's not just verbal communication, but how do you guys communicate the most?
Yeah, so we have a Monday morning meeting where the entire team, every department is in it, and we download on every case, or at least every case that, you know, that overlaps. Obviously, we get a ton of maintenance. Not everybody on the team needs to know about the maintenance treatment we did Tuesday morning, but anything that carries over to any other departments, we're, you know, kind of putting it out there. We, sports medicine wise, have a team meeting, and then we also have a team meeting with strength and conditioning pretty regularly. So each department's slightly different, but obviously the most touch points are between us and strength and conditioning, largely because they kind of, with that, the rehab continuum, we kind of see it as this, obviously almost like two wedge pieces fit together, where at the beginning of a rehab, sports medicine is the primary lead, and as our responsibilities kind of trickle out, S&C kind of continues to gain, you know, their lead in that athlete.
That totally makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. There's not ever really a day that they're not in on the S&C floor. You know, basically outside of maybe that first 7 to 10 days, once the athlete kind of generally feels well after surgery, we'll get them out there and they're doing either the uninvolved limb, upper body, lower body, you know, whatever, you know, body half that it's not on. And obviously we're, you know, directing that to some degree, especially when it comes to that post-op leg. Most of our touch points are with them, you know, informal communication with nutrition. You know, the second we have an athlete go into a concussion protocol, we text one of our dietitians on staff, say, hey, this athlete's going into the concussion protocol for us. They basically come right downstairs. They have a whole, you know, brain health protocol essentially that they kind of put them in as soon as they're made aware as well.
A nutrition brain health. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So yeah, it's awesome. You know, whether it's concussion, you know, that I think that's a big piece that a lot of places miss too, right? Because oftentimes a university has one or two dietitians for all of their sports. So
yeah,
of course football gets most resources, specifically if it's a Division I program.
Elevate your knowledge, ignite your curiosity, and compete with the best minds at events hosted by the American Academic Competition Institute. AACI's sports medicine competitions feature practical exercises, challenging quizzes, specialty tests, and keynote speakers that foster knowledge and social engagement in healthcare and sports medicine. Go to aacitest.org for more information on upcoming regional and national competitions. Sign up for the Ultimate Intellectual Showdown.
So yeah, having that in-house, like, oh, I got somebody who's got a soft tissue injury. You know, it's a lot of anti-inflammatories, stuff like that. You know, I got bone health, or, you know, I got a bone injury. They're putting them on, you know, a bone health package. Like I said, the concussion's multifactorial. It's altering their diet. So where it's more of a ketogenic diet initially to kind of restore those balances within the brain and the body. It's a product from, we use a lot of Thorn supplements. So a product called Cinequil from Thorn basically has ketone esters in it, you know, omega-3s, all those kind of neuroprotective regenerative stuff.
And I noticed on the performance services site of UFC, the PI Institute, Thorn is spelled T-H-O-R-N-E. So if any of our listeners want to check out that information, we are not sponsored by Thorn, at least not yet. So, hey guys at Thorn, if you're kind of curious, please take a peek. No, it looks very interesting. And it's really cool how you pull everybody in as a staff and keep it, like you said, it's multidisciplinary. And a lot of places don't understand that. So my hat's off to you. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's great to work in an environment. Like at the Olympic Training Center, we tried to say that it was more multidisciplinary than it was interdisciplinary, because it was still, obviously, with people traveling as crazy amounts as they did at the Olympic Training Center, finding sports psych, finding dietitians, like, was always kind of hard to do. So it was kind of just left to the athlete at that point, where it's all of us kind of whole, holistic approach.
So we're talking a lot of fast pace, a lot of moving parts, a lot of pieces to the puzzle. Can you talk about documentation? You talk that, they have an hour, maybe 30 minutes. Do you get time in between? Are you just jotting stuff down?
No, we've got blocks throughout the week where we have admin time that we'll chat, or we use Smartabase as our platform for athlete monitoring and our documentation needs. So yeah, that's kind of falls on each individual. I'm pretty good at being able to go a couple of days and remembering what exactly I did with the athlete a few days ago. I guess depending on the week, sometimes it's like, oh, I don't even remember what I did with you an hour ago. So
Victoria will say that's me every day, so watch it.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've got, like I said, we've got the 8 to 5, and most of that time's directed towards, athlete care. But, we have the ability to go in and block our schedule off and get caught up on admin stuff, because we're actually about to start filming for it, but we create a bunch of content as well. So a lot of educational content right now, kind of more for, it's this company called Migu, based out of China, creating levels of certification for them. Eventually that'll become, a US, not even just the US, but just kind of general provider certifications as well. So you can, if you're a strength and conditioning coach, you can go to the PI and get level 1 S&C coach certified, or you're an athletic trainer, you can be like, I'm UFC PI level 2.
So this would be a specialty for UFC athletic trainers, sports medics, nutritionists, whatever.
Exactly. So,
Interesting, interesting.
and the idea behind it is to kind of help identify practitioners in every department space to provide care for the athletes, like, worldwide, right? So we have over 600 athletes on the roster, 30 to 40 of which live in Vegas. So that leaves a bunch to be cared for remotely. Obviously, S&C can do quite a bit remotely. They can push programs remotely and hope the athlete does them well without anybody supervising. A little hard to provide physical therapy and recovery type tools remotely.
Just not the same. We found that out during the pandemic. Hands-on through Zoom just doesn't work, right?
Not quite. Yeah. Until there's an actual portal where I can stick my hand through the screen and actually touch you, then,
Man, that'd be great. I'd make so much money. I'd like to figure that out quick.
yeah. So it allows us to identify a network of providers, like you said, whether it's dietitians, whether it's sports medicine related, whether it's S&C, that know exactly what we try to implement here and isn't just wasting the athlete's time. Because we've had so many athletes come through. We'll get somebody 5.5 months into their post-op ACL rehab, just kind of pop in for a few days and want us to treat them. Obviously, are you doing rehab? Yes, I'm doing rehab. And then by the time that they're, done with the week with us, they're like, oh, maybe I really haven't been doing rehab. Like, this is
Gotta
completely
love the honesty, right?
So, generally the conception of what is good medical care and what it actually is kind of two different perceptions for sure. So that's what the certification will kind of help with, is identifying practitioners that we can send the athletes to.
Outsource to people that are available elsewhere. You got somebody in Michigan and they're that far from Vegas. Maybe you have a clinician you can trust. That makes total sense.
Right, exactly. So
You're working for all these years. You do a lot of clinical, you do a lot of oversight of post events. What are the most common injuries you see among these UFC fighters?
yeah, I'd say the biggest thing that we deal with on a regular daily basis is kind of like neck, shoulder, and then hip and low back. So I guess call it chronic mechanical issues, if you will. Obviously the fighter posture isn't this good, shoulders back, head up, chin out. That kind of exposes you a little bit
That's a big target right there, right?
for some issues, right?
Yep.
So all shoulders rounded, chin tucked into their shoulder type of thing. So they may look like they're in a neck forward position. So their neck forward, or I guess head forward, neck extended type of position. So that leads to its own issues within the cervical spine. And then obviously their anterior musculature quite a bit tighter, more tonic than their posterior musculature. So yeah, kind of anything cervical, upper thoracic, we deal with quite regularly. And then kind of same type of deal, lower body. They do a lot where they're in a hip flex position, right? They're slightly forward even when they're standing up. When they're wrestling, obviously we know the wrestling posture is kind of bent over at the waist. Jiu-jitsu is a similar posture, you know, a lot of time on their back, hips flexed, kind of in a guard position. And then obviously just our daily lives lead us to sitting around a lot more. This population, you know, they drive a lot to and from practices. This population also plays a lot of video games. So even just our posture outside of the gym leads to a lot of these issues. So yeah, it's an anterior pelvic tilt. It's that forward trunk lean, then the lumbar extension to get back out of it. Those are kind of the things that we see pretty consistently. As far as
how do you usually end up treating those issues?
Well, yeah, a lot of it, you know, obviously, very simply, obviously releasing the anterior musculature, whether it's hip flexors, pecs, subscaps, and then strengthening posterior, right? And strengthening the core. Granted, you know, when we think of boxers and fighters, we think these guys have amazing cores and they do have really good six pack, but not a very good functional core. You know, it's just really just strictly that rectus. It's nothing else involved. It's not transverse. It's not obliques. It's really just the rectus. So it's a lot of re-education there, a lot of training that. And then posterior shoulder strengthening and stabilization are kind of how we combat those two that seem to be the most successful. I'd say too, another thing that we see quite a bit, which I would say is pretty unusual, is, and I think it's growing popularity within sports, is the ACL coper, right? We have a ton of ACLs that end up being able to compete at a very high level without getting the surgery. Particularly, obviously, our sport, we're not running and cutting and changing directions a ton, so that kind of helps. We also have this theory that for our athletes, it's a micro trauma after micro trauma. And eventually, you know, they throw one more kick and that's when they feel the pop. But we don't ever really see a ton of, you know, any of that acute response where it's a ton of swelling, loss of function, loss of range of motion.
Really?
We don't really see that. So we're like, okay. And then, you know, we put them through a ton of functional tests. And a lot of times even that leg tests better than their healthy leg does. So
funny how that works sometimes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pretty, you know, it's definitely something really interesting that we've seen that, you know, it's that mechanism of the kick where they're kind of hyperextending, making, you know, impact that we think is just kind of breaking down the ACL time and time and time and time again. And then you finally have that final, you know, final snap of what's left. And yeah, no real swelling. You know, I've missed several ACL diagnoses because you're like, yeah, okay, it feels a little loose, but like, you don't have any swelling. You still have a good quad control, you know, full range of motion. And you're just like, and then they finally get the MRI and you're like, oh, well, I feel like an idiot because I missed that.
Been there once or twice myself. Yep, yeah. I know how that is.
Yeah. I mean, shoot, we just had somebody that had a fib fracture and she was walking on it right away. And you know, totally missed that. But then after like, you know, a week, just we're like, okay, something's just not right here. She didn't really want to get an x-ray because she was fighting in a couple of weeks, and we're like, well, let's just get one. We'd hate to like hate for it to be this, and it ended up being that.
Wow.
But she was fully functional. I was doing, you know, little, you know, mini, like, I guess lunge bounds or whatever you want to call them, and no pain, no nothing. And yeah.
So mentally and physically tough. Wow. Yeah,
the pain threshold here is a little different.
Just a bit. Yeah. Scale of 0 to 10. You get worried when they hit 14, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You think you'd never miss a fib fracture in your career. And then it turns out we all missed it.
What specific skills and experiences do you think are most valuable as an athletic trainer to succeed in the UFC environment?
In the UFC, for sure, being able to, I guess, just handle chaotic situations, I think is the biggest, I guess, like non-actual technical skill. But, you know, I'm always one that kind of stays pretty even kill. Like, you can't get me too high or really too low. And I think, you know, in a sport that can be so chaotic, dramatic, And when things go wrong, it can be really wrong. That staying even kill, is kind of, pretty good skill to have. You know, we're, like I said, we compete 42 to 44 weekends a year. So we don't really have an off season. So it's being able to, manage that throughout the year.
Sometimes we sit there at a good football season. I pick on football because of the trauma in that. And we see so many things every year. But a long season for football is, including preseason, maybe 16 to 18 weeks. So you're saying 42 to 44. And the amount of bouts in that weekend, just that's amazing.
Yeah. So for it to be an official like fight card for us, it has to have at least 12 fights on it. And I would say pretty good portion of ours have, I would say most of them have at least 13 on them. And sometimes during COVID, they would overstack a card with like 15, 16 fights just because they were half expecting to lose three or four of them.
Right.
And sometimes all of those fights would make it to Saturday night. And so that turned into be a long night.
And that includes all the different weight divisions, classifications, and both men and women.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, you've got, four women's divisions on top of all of the divisions for the men. Well, maybe like three and a half. That 145-pound division for the women, like, sometimes exists, sometimes it doesn't. Just kind of depends on the talent. So there's not too many of them in that weight division. So it just kind of depends on how many cycle through.
Yeah, I'm looking right now. That title is vacant. So, Victoria, if we can get you to 145 and get you out there to Vegas training, you could be a world champion.
Didn't we just talk about me stubbing my toe?
Yeah, but apparently I can handle it. This is different. So,
oh, Eli, you just want me out. It's okay.
I never said that. I'm looking at a world title for you. So, just trying to help your career.
It is
funny when a lot of people come through and take tours, we'll kind of joke with them and kind of give them the realistic point of view of what the MMA fighter goes through, because they typically will, so they don't fight at their, or they don't walk around at their fight weight, right? So that's also another component that we have to deal with, obviously, because they're like calorie depleted towards the end of their fight camps, but obviously nutrition department really has to work with. Somebody who fights at 135 pounds isn't necessarily not going to be 170 pounds when they start fight camp. So the whole, 8 weeks, usually a fight camp is 8 weeks. We're starting to think that they don't need to be 8 weeks long, because you see, big handfuls of injuries kind of at those, at 4 and 5 week mark of camp. So, maybe shrinking it down 2 weeks, 6 week camp sounds a little bit better. It's just that's how they've always done it. This sport's very, my boxing coach who fought in the 1700s did it that way. So you're going to continue to do it the same way. So you deal with all of that. And then ideally they check in. So the fight week for the fighter, they check into whatever host city we're at on a Tuesday typically. And then our nutrition team wants them at about 10%, 10 to 12% over their fight weight that Tuesday. So 135 pounds, you're looking at 148 pounds Tuesday to weigh in Friday morning at 136 pounds.
Wow.
Friday. So, yeah. So our nutrition team has, a huge brick wall in front of them that they have to try and push over half the time. And that's through, micronutrient manipulation, macronutrient manipulation, fluid manipulation, to get them to a point where some of them roughly cut 8 to 9 pounds Thursday night. That's what we kind of call our acute weight cut, is Thursday night into Friday morning when they weigh in.
Now, is that going to be a lot of the water weight that they're trying to get rid of that last night?
So there's kind of, two theories. So what our dietitian team does is we also have culinary chefs that go on the road with us that cook for the athletes when they opt into that. So the athlete, all these guys are independent contractors. So they don't really have to do anything we tell them. If I say, hey, you've got a concussion, this is our protocol, like, we hope and we pray that they listen.
And because they're not your employee. Got it.
Yeah. Like, we don't cut them checks. you know, they only get checks if they make it to Saturday night and fight. So, you know, it's not like, you know, the team, you know, not like an NFL team that has control over all their power, you know, their players like they do. They don't have to listen to us. So, yeah, they are pulling out all sodium fight week. They're opting, if the athlete opts into these services, they're pulling sodium, they're pulling fiber. And then we typically, there's kind of two theories of this water manipulation. It's either water loading or water tapering. So it seems like a very, you know, kind of Latin American country thing to do, South American country thing to do, to water taper. So you drink a lot more Monday, and then throughout the week, you kind of slowly decrease to nothing on Thursday. Where we really push them to do water loading, which means they may be drinking up to, you know, six, depending on how far they're over or how large of an individual they are, maybe getting them to drink up to 6 liters a day going into Thursday. So basically, all right, doing the same thing, you're dehydrating yourself, but you're not totally miserable because you're consuming some sort of liquid.
Right.
Then Thursday, they kind of cut that out. Sometimes they'll have meals depending on how heavy they are. Sometimes they don't get meals Thursday. And then Thursday night is kind of where they do the sauna weight cut, the sauna suits, the hot tubs, all of that type of stuff. So either Thursday night or Friday morning. And then they typically weigh in at 9 a.m. local time Friday morning and then compete sometime Saturday.
And right after that 9 a.m. wait, they rush to the chow line and find the chef.
We hope not. Yeah, it's a very, just as much of a process stripping it out as it is putting it back in, right? So it's all calculated. They get rehydration. They're supposed to sip over. So their initial, you know, they've got basically two water bottles. It's supposed to take them about an hour to get through both of them. And they have, you know, electrolytes, a simple carb. We use something like Vertargo, but it's just kind of a simple liquid carb that they can kind of ingest and start to kind of reintroduce some of that stuff back into the body. Some of their feeding too is based around that, right? Like some simple, like banana bread, bagel, something simple that they can kind of keep down. And as long as they can kind of keep reintroducing that stuff, they can kind of continue on, you know, back as they need. And then again, on that end of it, it's not uncommon for them to be 20 pounds heavier going into the cage Saturday night than what they were Friday morning.
That's just amazing.
Yeah. We do the most unjust thing to the body about 36 hours before we want to go perform at its highest. So it's wild,
man. Just crazy.
But that's nice to hear, you know, that it is very calculated. It's monitored. It's safe, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, that's been a big shift that we have kind of seen. And I've been here for 7 years now. So it's been a big shift. And, you know, the athletes starting to see themselves as a professional athlete 365 days a year instead of now before it was a professional athlete 8 weeks at a time. So literally your fight camp would literally be fat camp. And all you're trying to do is lose weight to get to weight. You're not learning anything new. You're not maintaining anything that you may have built in your off season. And so, yeah, we talk about it all the time about how maybe some of this should change and what the process could be better to eliminate some of the weight cutting, but somebody's always going to do it because they're always going to think that there's an advantage to being the heavier person. So we just make it as safe as possible, which a lot of our research shows that it's not always the best to be the heaviest person in the octagon. A lot of times we've got the data to kind of support the fact that a lot of times the guys miss weight. They're not the more successful one Saturday night, which is interesting.
So that's very interesting.
It's all about the balance of like basically how much weight can you cut but still recover and perform optimally, right? Like if you cut too much weight, you're just going to feel like complete, you know, crap in the octagon Saturday night. That's kind of the balance. And a lot of guys are thinking or are realizing, okay, if I can somehow like permanently shave 5 pounds off, and that's 5 pounds less that I have to cut, I feel better in the octagon. Plus now you're at a whole new weight that you haven't been training at the last 2 weeks of your camp anyway. So yeah, so it's definitely multifactorial, right? If you're last two weeks of your fight, you're 148 pounds, and then you go back into the cage and you're now 158 pounds, like you're now fighting Saturday night at something you haven't been 2-3 weeks.
That'd be rough on the body.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Really rough. Really rough.
Yeah, I mean the sport itself is not really good on the body.
That's an understatement, right?
Yeah.
Well, I definitely have one more question for you. And if Victoria wants to add right after or has something she wants to ask, I will definitely step aside for that. But is there anything else you could share with our listeners about the importance of athletic trainers in the UFC and its commitment to health and safety?
Yeah, you know, I think athletic trainers in general with sports, it's not even specific to the UFC, are just a vital role. I heard it, somebody, you know, summarize it once that you wouldn't send your kid to a pool without a lifeguard. So why would you send?
Amen. Amen.
Why would you send your kid to a sporting event or practice without an athletic trainer?
I love that.
And, you know, that's kind of always resonated with me. Obviously, my role is like I would kind of say I'm not your traditional athletic trainer. I kind of more walk and talk like a physical therapist, so to speak, just because of the, you know, the roles and stuff. But we're usually the first line of care, whether it's, you know, and largely emergency based. So in those first few minutes, even first few seconds, like it's so critical to get solid care, you know, that's where the importance of the athletic trainer comes in for sure.
For aspiring athletic trainers, yep, what would be your biggest advice for them to get into UFC or maybe shadow or get some sort of hands-on experience there?
Yeah, I would say, you know, we definitely take students. We currently have an agreement with UNLV, the local college here, obviously.
Go Rebels.
Yep. And then some of the grad programs that are switching to that, like that senior spring semester. So basically the last semester in their curriculum being a totally immersive experience. So they can do it basically all remotely because they don't have to be in class for it. So we're potentially having a student from the University of South Carolina next spring. So yeah, I would say, you know, those are definitely pathways that we're open to and can accommodate as best as possible. I would say just in general, like making those networking connections, whether it's at conferences, whether it's the UFC or just professional sports you want to be in general, making those connections, always being a hard worker. I would say nothing prepared me more for the professional world than you know, being the grunt sometimes and stocking the lotion bottles, stacking the towels and making sure the clinic's kind of picked up at the end of the day. Like, no, that's not what we want to be. But like that as an employer goes really far, right? Like your clinical skills like can be taught and learned at whatever level that you're at. We obviously all have to go get CEUs every year. So you're going to continue to learn. You're going to be better at your craft. Like that hard work, that work ethic is just kind of unspoken to. You know, we've got a coworker who he's been in the NFL a handful of years and has been here now for 3 years. But yeah, you know, if he was, you know, interns, if they came through and, you know, weren't putting that work ethic in, like, you know, you didn't get any reference to the next level for full-time employee. And you know, that spreads. This profession's large, but it's very small at the same time. Almost everybody knows everybody. So, and then just putting those volunteer hours in, right? Like when we go through job application process, we look to make sure that they have some sort of like combat experience. So there may not be the most of opportunities in MMA specifically. I think those opportunities are growing, but it's wrestling, it's boxing, it's judo. It's just some sort of combat experience. Because like we've talked about for the last hour that it's unlike no other, really. I would say those are kind of my two advice points that I always give everybody is that get that experience somehow, whether it's volunteer, whether it's an internship, and then the work ethic. It's student that, you know, fills the water bottles, packs the towels, all that, like, doesn't go unnoticed for sure.
You said two words we hear over and over and over: network, bigger the better, get to know people, shake hands. And work ethic goes so far. So true.
Yep.
Well, Bobby, really, thank you so much. This was such an educational hour for us. I know, well, at least I can say that for myself. Victoria, maybe she has a lot more experience than I over her year of being certified. So I'm going to go with that. But I really want to say thank you. This was awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. You have a great day and a great weekend, and hope you get to stay right around 40 hours every week.
Thanks to you guys as well.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Want to make sure you hear every episode? Remember to like, follow, and subscribe to our podcast. Don't forget to share our podcast with your colleagues, family, and friends. Your support will help more people find and enjoy our content. Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More is directed by Eli Haller. It is produced by Gabriel Haller. Our theme music is by Coma Studios via Pixabay. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the contributors. Want to know more about us? Visit us at wrapituppodcast.com. That's with one P, wrapituppodcast.com. Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More is a production of Halleck Consulting, LLC.